Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, literary editor Matthew Schmitz recounts his day in court and reads aloud from Tocqueville. We learn that if the author of Democracy in America were alive today, he would tell us that what this country needs is more jury trials. Then, Confucius meets Woodrow Wilson in Matthew's back page from our November issue, inspired by his years at Princeton. Matthew will explain the meaning of tool, the favorite epithet of Ivy League undergrads. We learn that if John Henry Newman were alive today, he would tell us to stop majoring in public policy. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups: the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. Then there are the private citizens who get called up for jury duty and do their best to get selected or rejected, as the case may be. These are their stories.
Last week I was called for jury duty in New York County, so I went to downtown Manhattan and along with maybe 300 other people filed into a government office building and sat there seeing if I would be selected for any jury. It was a wonderful experience. I think that it was my initiation into the real New York. People move to New York and they move out of New York very quickly. And it's hard to feel like you're actually a New Yorker unless you've been born here. But I think going through this, I finally can now call myself a New Yorker.
Are you at liberty to disclose what the crime was that you might have been put on a jury
for? I am. So I was not selected for a jury. I, along with 70 other jurors, was brought into a courtroom where jury selection proceeded. The crime was an armed robbery and assault. The prosecutor was very competent and focused, and the defense team was not. The legal representation for this man who had allegedly robbed and injured a woman was not up to snuff. Imagine if I went up and began defending someone in a criminal case. I would seem hesitating. I would lack confidence. I would misspeak in gross and obvious ways. This is effectively what was happening. So the idea that we have a kind of parity in our criminal justice system, a rough parity between the prosecution and the defense, which is what you see in most of these dramas, Law and Order, what have you, is not the norm. The defense attorneys were obviously incompetent, and whatever the merits of the case, I very much doubted that the defendant was going to get a vigorous and thoroughgoing defense.
So what about the other folks in your jury pool?
A lot of people don't want to serve jury duty, right? So one person stood up and he told the judge that he had been mugged when he was young, so he didn't think he'd be able to serve on this jury because it had been very traumatic for him and he had been going to therapy ever since. The judge said, "You wouldn't be able to serve on this criminal trial or on any criminal trial?" And the man said, "Any criminal trial." And the judge told him, "Well, civil cases always take longer, but we'll mark your card civil and we'll send you there." And another person who had raised his hand to stand up and try to get out of this service then put his hand back down. Another woman said that she couldn't serve because she had a homework assignment due. This was a student at Yeshiva, and she said it was a very big assignment and her scholarship hinged on it, and she really couldn't do jury duty because she wouldn't be able to complete her homework. Anyway, it was funny to see the judge have these conversations with people, see the kind of hilarious excuses that people will create to get out of jury duty. Some of it is a bit less funny. You know, when someone's asked, "Can you justly assess the facts, or are you prejudiced against any of the parties?" One woman was asked this, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm not sure that I would be able to believe the police because I was assaulted by police officers, and there was some kind of inquiry into this, and they lied, and I ended up being vindicated, but I do not believe what the police say." So that was the reaction of a woman from Harlem, different from the reactions of people who lived in Midtown East, who might say, "Well, my cousin's a police officer, so whatever the police say, I'm going to think they're right. So you kind of get it. You get a view of everyone in the city. Of course, maybe my favorite person who was in the pool with me was a woman who, when asked if she had done anything related to criminal justice in her career, said yes, she had. Her career is acting, and she has appeared on Law and Order. And the judge was very interested in this and asked her what roles she'd appeared in. She said, "Well, I've been a judge, and I've been a defense attorney, and I've been a jury member, and I've been a victim." Now, a friend of mine in college was a victim on Law and Order, and a lot of people have been. And we had one of them in the room, and the judge asked if she would be able to distinguish real life from Law and Order, and she said, yes, she would be able to do it. But she still wasn't selected, because even that, they're a little bit worried. If you know a little bit too much about criminal justice, they won't want to have you.
And so, Matthew, were you trying to get out of jury duty, or were you trying to get into jury duty?
So I just, you know, abandoned myself to fate in the matter. I think it would have been dishonorable to try to get out of jury duty. And so I answered all the questions that were posed to me as directly as I could. It was asked what I do. I said I worked at a religious magazine. The judge was quite interested in that. He said, if you're a religious person, will you be able to judge someone else, or will you refuse to sit in judgment over another person?
Lest ye be judged.
And I told the judge that it would be no problem for me. I didn't get into it, but that's not really my religious hang-up. Whatever my religious hang-up may be, it is not kind of vague non-judgmentalism. But I think the prosecutor was probably worried about that, and so I got booted. I guess Pope Francis, and may all of us who need to spend more time in the office bless him for this, is making it harder for us to serve on juries with his non-judgmental talk. Now, I go on so much about what the jury selection process was like, because one of the most important things about jury service is not necessarily that it guarantees better outcomes for the defendants or for the victims. I'm sure there's a body of research on this. I have no idea what it says, but for a long time, people who have defended the idea of jury service have defended it for the education that it provides to people who serve on juries, an education in citizenship. These are the lines on which Tocqueville defends it in classic terms in his book, Democracy in America. I happen to have my copy here, and I will read a bit of what Tocqueville said. Of jury duty, Tocqueville tells us, it vests each citizen with a sort of magistracy. It makes all feel that they have duties towards society to fulfill as they enter into its government. In forcing men to occupy themselves with something other than their own affairs, it combats individual selfishness, which is like the blight of societies. The jury serves incredibly to form the judgment and to augment the natural enlightenment of the people. There, in my opinion, is its greatest advantage. One ought to consider it as a school, free of charge and always open, where each juror comes to be instructed in his rights, where he enters into daily communication with the most instructed and most enlightened members of the elevated classes, where the laws are taught to him in a practical manner and are put within reach of his intelligence by the efforts of the attorneys, the advice of the judge, and the very passions of the parties. I think that the practical intelligence and good political sense of the Americans must principally be attributed to the long use that they have made of the jury in civil matters. I do not know if the jury is useful to those who have lawsuits, but I am sure that it is very useful to those who judge them. I regard it as one of the most efficacious means society can make use of for the education of the people. Now that's a very warm commendation of the whole system of trial by jury. What Tocqueville did not know then was that America would largely retreat from jury trials. Today, very few cases ever reach the jury stage. You know, plea bargains are incredibly common. The rise of plea bargaining has many causes, many effects. One of its worst manifestations is something called the Alford plea. The Alford plea is a guilty but not guilty plea. So you formally concede that you have committed the crime, but you do not actually admit guilt. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't. But it's a way of getting the party to formally admit that they did something, and so then the case can be closed. But since they don't actually admit guilt, the whole process ceases to serve a moral function, in which there has to be a confession of guilt and then a restoration to society after you have confessed guilt. By confessing guilt, you restore the victim by acknowledging the truth that they possess. So guilty, not guilty pleas, or Alford pleas, are one of the worst aspects of our retreat from jury trials. They're opposed very strongly by professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Stefanos Bibas, who's written for First Things. It's a very good book, The Machinery of Criminal Justice, which I reviewed for us a few years back.
Did you tell the judge about that?
No, I did not tell him that I had done some writing on criminal justice. I've also written in defense of the death penalty, which I think the church, the Catholic Church, is very foolish to denigrate today. I'm skeptical about the death penalty's use right now in America, just as a practical prudential matter. But I think in principle it's essential for any system of justice. So there are some people who simply cannot be reintegrated into society given the crimes they have committed. And in that case, the only fitting punishment is capital.
Chapter 2, Analect 12. The Master Said, A Gentleman Is Not a Pot. Chapter 5, Analect 4. Zigong asked, What do you think of me? The Master said, You are a pot. What sort of pot? A precious ritual vase. In his back page column in our November issue, Matthew Schmitz uses these analects of Confucius to argue that nobody should ever attend Princeton. Matthew, will you explain the connection?
Happily. When I was at Princeton in the 2000s, the most popular insult on campus was tool. This was used to denigrate anyone who appeared to be trying too hard to succeed. You know, it was wielded by the kids who were already privileged, who came from successful families, against those other students, say, children of Chinese immigrants or Nigerians or what have you, who are trying to scramble their way into the upper class. We publish a lot of things in First Things talking about the technocratic regime or the technocratic age, you know, the technocratic mentality. You know, I think that Pope Francis speaks in similar terms in Laudato Si, about a way that a utilitarian calculus, a view of people as means rather than ends, is increasingly dominant in society. I agree with that argument, but I wanted to make it in somewhat simpler terms. And so I talked about this phenomenon of labeling other students as tools. And my argument, drawing on Confucius, was that we will often seem like tools if we don't direct ourselves at higher ends. And what are those higher ends? Fellowship with God, and along with that, love and real concern for our fellow men in themselves and not as implements for our own use and abuse.
So you would update Confucius as saying his analect, a gentleman is not a pot, you would rephrase as a gentleman is not a tool.
I would, though you're losing some of that wonderful, odd flavor. But yeah, that would be my grim retranslation. A gentleman is not a tool. You know, it might sound rather precious to talk about campus life at Princeton University and, you know, what gentlemen are or are not. But for Confucius, a gentleman was someone who pursued knowledge and virtue, which he viewed as inextricably related.
When Confucius tells his follower, you are a precious ritual vase, can you translate that into Princetonian English?
Well, there's a very elaborate and polite culture on campus of mincing pseudo-debauchery. People talk about the horrible hookup culture at these elite institutions, and it does have its horrors, but these people are very privileged and, for the most part, though by no means unanimously insulated from its effects. There is sexual assault. There is depression, this, that, VDs, or whatever they happen to be called now.
STIs.
STIs, right. there's all this on campus, but the truth is it's done in a very polite way. People act as pots or as tools, but they're not just plain old tools. They're precious ritual vases. They're, you know, really fine tools in which a lot of investment has been placed and who've received great polish. They hook up, but instead of doing it in a kind of bacchanal, they carefully and hygienically, with an eye to social advantage, couple. They do drugs, but they don't do party drugs, right? They do study drugs. You know, a party drug is something that gives you release, but might set back your career. A study drug helps you get that job at McKinsey or Bain. So I remember at the end of my senior year talking to a bunch of members of my eating club one night, eating club being an absurd institution. They're devoted to all of these toolish activities. And I realized that they had all been doing drugs to improve their studies. Not to party, but to study all 4 years.
So there are two things that are being, two major things that are instrumentalized on the Princeton campus, right? Education, you know, there's a very utilitarian view of education, and also the body. And so as an emblem of these two different kinds of instrumentalization, you talk about two different buildings on campus that are nicknamed Tool Shed.
One is the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy and International Affairs, which certain people have sought to rename recently because of Woodrow Wilson's odious racial views. There's the Woodrow Wilson School, that's one tool shed, and that's, you know, classic location for people who devote their minds to an instrumental form of knowledge, studying what? Not theology, no, not classics. Not even English, nothing with a definite discipline or set approach, but set an interdisciplinary, practically oriented tech school for technocrats. That's what public policy is. That was one such tool shed. The other, facing it across the street, is the Princeton Tower Club, which was my own eating club, a club that was selective in a brutal meritocratic way, but not genteelly exclusive. There were other more properly aristocratic clubs, the ones that people like Fitzgerald were in. Mine was not so august. Now, most people won't go to such strange and pseudo-aristocratic institutions as I happen to, but the mores that are promoted on campus do reflect and also affect a broader culture. People tend to identify up in a society like ours. Divorce hit the upper class before it hit the middle or the lower class in America. And so it's worth bringing some thought and attention to the way people are living on these campuses, because those are the people who will be shaping the country.
That's interesting, because it seems to me that recently there's been a great deal of interest in these campus cultures, these elite campus cultures, on the part of opinion journalists. So in 2005, Walter Kern wrote Lost in the Meritocracy for The Atlantic. In 2013, Helen Andrews wrote Sex in the Meritocracy for First Things. In 2016, Matthew Schmitz has written Pots in the Meritocracy. So the meritocracy...
Ooh, feet of clay on that statue.
The meritocracy, specifically its Ivy League training ground, has become a topic of great interest for opinion journalists, and I was going to ask you why, but maybe that's why. I don't know. Do you have anything to add?
Well, these opinion journalists went to those institutions. Kern went to Princeton, the culture of which is exactly the same today as it was in the 80s when he went there. His essay could be read as a manual for survival on campus today. And Helen went to Yale, of course. So, yeah, people went to these schools, people want their children to go to these schools, though I think more and more people are having doubts about that as they realize that the quality of education is not that high. If you can guarantee opportunities to your offspring otherwise, why put them through it? So, yeah, there's just people love to play on the anxiety of readers, the social anxiety. So these essays... though Kearns and Andrews are both surpassing the broader genre, deals in that. In the same way that The Atlantic would run something about, you know, can women really have it all? Well, I didn't realize that anyone could.
What is the antidote to the various instrumentalizations that arise in the meritocracy, not just on these campuses, but in our broader culture? Should we all be reading that chapter of Newman's Idea of the University on knowledge, its own end? Should we retreat to Benedict option communities?
I think that we can begin with ourselves. We can devote our intelligence to contemplation of the highest things. You know, we live in an age of great literacy. So instead of reading books like Freakonomics, which degrade the intelligence of anyone who is immersed in them, we should read Scripture and the Fathers and put our minds on God. We should also devote our bodies to God. We should treat them as things set apart, not for our use, not for mere pleasure, for this or that. We should practice chastity. There's nothing that revolutionary in this, or it's at least not new, though it's difficult and its implications would be revolutionary in a way. That's why there are organizations like the Love and Fidelity Network, led by a woman I very much admire, Caitlin Seary, and they found these groups called Anscombe Societies on university campuses, and they are not mere chastity clubs, you know, urging their members to remain neutral as Switzerland, as everyone else invades and is invaded on campus. They also sponsor very serious and important intellectual events, and so they have an intuition that we have to discipline our bodies as well as our minds and offer both together to something higher. So Julia, let me turn the tables here. I know that you just completed your graduate studies at Yale after attending the University of Pennsylvania. Did you see on either of those campuses elements of the culture that I tried to describe?
I think that Yale is a far less toolish campus than Princeton. But I have to say that, from one's perch on the Yale campus, one really doesn't think too much about Princeton. Think about Harvard, less so about Princeton. In seriousness, a graduate student's perspective is very different, I think, from an undergrad's perspective. So just the student culture at the graduate level is very different. It's far more focused. It's not relaxed exactly, but there's less of that totalizing pressure to perform brilliantly in five different disciplines at once, you know, and then do study drugs in order to make that happen. And no one's thinking about, you know, am I going to get a lucrative job in finance when I come out of this? We all know that we're not. You know, we're hoping to be genteelly poor. So there's a sort of clarity and focus that I think depressurizes the academic obligations in a way. And there's also just nothing like, I think largely because of the age difference, there's nothing like the kind of social pressure at the graduate level in the Ivy League as there is for the undergrads. There are also just aren't those same institutions that facilitate that sort of thing. There are no eating clubs for grad students. There are no final clubs or secret societies for grad students. Now, as to your question about my undergraduate years, you misspoke when you said that I went to the University of Pennsylvania. I didn't. I didn't go to UPenn. I don't know anyone who did or anyone who would. Like most sensible young people in the state of Pennsylvania, I attended the Pennsylvania State University, which is a very, very different kind of place. It's interesting, though. This is one of the things that I have thought about in response to your back page. You know, so you're discussing the way in which on an elite campus for undergrads, knowledge and the body are particularly instrumentalized. you know, why should that not be even more the case at an institution such as I attended as an undergrad, which is, you know, a major land-grant state university, not a liberal arts college, you know, a research-based state institution. At a place like that, you would expect all the more. I mean, it's DNA. It's sort of, it's programmed to be devoted to an idea of knowledge as instrumental, you know, knowledge to improve our ag programs. So the English department, I was an English major, it fits very weirdly into a campus that, you know, it has that kind of historical formation.
Well, I think my response to that good point that you raise.
Well, and let me finish up too.
Sure.
That, you know, Penn State is a notorious party school. Most of the students party hard on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Maybe they do that at Princeton too, but there's, you know, a huge culture of binge drinking, frat parties, tailgating, things like this. So, right, and there are all sorts of toolish sexual things that go on pertinent to that. So these things happen numerically at least as much or all the more on a campus like Penn State's. So I just wonder whether you can comment on a difference that you perceive there. Is there?
There's more commonality than difference between the two. One thing I wanted to highlight in my description of the culture I encountered on campus was the way in which a instrumental mindset is combined with immense self-regard and a conviction that one is engaged in the most holy and unimpeachable activities. So there's the same basic mindset, but it's, you know, it's quite different to bring a you know, instrumental approach to knowledge when one is trying to, say, get a veterinary degree than when one fancies oneself a true scholar. But you know, the true scholar you are is one who only studies public policy, but the veterinarian has studied a real discipline. They have actual practical knowledge. They put it to good use. And their pretensions, their kind of their self-conception is much more modest. If someone goes and studies public policy, they actually haven't learned anything that's as definite as what the veterinarian has, but they think they can remake the world. I mean, it's that hubris and madness of combining what is essentially a kind of practical study with a kind of totally impractical aspiration to run the whole world that I think deserves to be criticized. But let's by all means have tech schools and more tech schools, but tech schools that train people to be technocrats who don't actually have any skills are something far more dangerous.
Just to be quite clear, Penn State is not a tech school, and you cannot get a veterinary degree there.
Well, I think that tech schools are very good things. My father went to a tech school and is an electrician, which is a good and an honest trade.
It is.
Manifestly unlike public policy.
Matthew, I know you admire Simon Lays, who was a translator of one major edition of Confucius Analects. Why do you consider Lays a significant figure?
Well, I enjoy spending time with him in his books. He has kind of wonderful critical gift of wandering through books and ideas and just taking the reader along with him. You know, he's not a programmatic thinker who's laying out some grand new philosophy. He's not a guru seeking disciples, but he's a wise, intelligent, curious man who's a devout Catholic Christian who relentlessly exposed the propaganda of the Chinese Communist Party, which was thoroughly accepted in Parisian intellectual circles in which he participated. He discredited the Maoists and was immensely unpopular for doing so. He also just did many kind of wonderful, strange little projects. He compiled a book about the sea and French literature. He's just a delightful author. I recommend all of his books. The Hall of Uselessness is a place to start, a collection of his essays, but there are other wonderful volumes that can be had as well with some effort.
So we'll end with a game called Real or Fake Confucius. I'll read an analect, and you can tell me, Matthew, whether it comes from real Confucius or fake Confucius.
Let's roll.
Confucius said of the head of the Zhi family, who used 8 rows of pantomimes in the ceremonies of his ancestral temple, if he can bear to do this, what may he not bear to do?
Real.
That's correct. Zigong wished to dispense with the sacrifice of a sheep for the new moon ceremony. The master said, "You love the sheep, I love the ceremony."
That is real, but I feel like it has maybe been, was it altered slightly?
It was not.
No, yeah, that is real. That's it's beautiful. Confucius was not a mere stickler for ceremonies, but he always wanted to understand and illuminate their logic.
The master never talked of miracles, violence, disorders, spirits, bears.
Correct. That is real.
No, there were no bears in the original. I falsified it.
Well done, well done.
Lord Ji Wen always thought thrice before acting. Hearing this, the master said, "Twice is enough."
Yeah, I think that's probably real.
That's real. The master said, "I am getting dreadfully old. It has been a long time since I last saw in a dream the red shoes of my ancestors' ritual garb."
That is totally invented. That's made up. That's some kind of Ratzinger fangirl invention. Is it not?
Yes and no. I adapted it. It's about half made up. But it is fake. The master said, "A man who can study for 3 years without giving a thought to his career is hard to find."
Yeah, that could be real, but I'm not sure. I'm gonna say that it's false.
It is real.
Dang. Oh well.
It should have been in your back page.
I didn't study for 3 years.
The master said, "Subsidiarity." Zigong said, "What the hell are you talking about?"
That's real. It's real.
That's correct. It's quite real. You win. You got most of them right.
Yeah, well, I have to study more and increase in virtue, and Confucius will be an aid in both.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Matthew Schmitz. And thank you, listeners.